If you were here last evening, or if you listened last evening or watched last evening, you'll remember that over these 3 days, our reflections for 40 hours are going to touch upon three stages of the spiritual life: the purgative, the illuminative, and the unitive. Once again, just to review, where do these stages come from? They're gleaned from centuries and centuries of Christian writers who have noticed. Common among the lives of all those who have come to become the friends of God are these three steps or stages. And once again, they're not discrete. One flows into the other the way, you know, one season flows into the other, or one time of day flows into the other. But they've begun to realize that at first one must take the axe to the root of sin. And that's what we went over last night. And a practical suggestion for how to do that was a little reflection on what prayer is and how to go about it. So this evening we're going to take the second of the three. And these get more mysterious as time goes on. We're going to talk about the illuminative stage. Now, the most difficult, most discouraging step in the spiritual life is always the first step. There's much that needs to change. There's much that needs to grow. There's old wounds that need to be healed. But if you take that first step, if you set the axe to the root of sin, you realize that what you're really defeating is the number one obstacle to your closeness of God in the first place. What you're really defeating is your ego. You start to empty yourself of yourself, and finally, you can be filled with God. This is where the illuminative stage begins. What's it like? What's it like? Well, I hope all this sounds familiar, because I'm trusting that anyone who shows up to 40-hour celebration on a cold February evening, you know, you're probably at least at the illuminative stage. And so this should sound familiar. You let down your defenses in the illuminative stage. You begin to know Christ himself incompletely, right? You know, for the first time ever, Christ is not, you know, out there as some kind of ruler of the universe or as the king of the universe. But, you know, for the first time, nobody needs to tell you about him, because you know him for who he really is, directly and personally and with you. And you experience more peace at all times, no matter what. And more trust and more freedom. This is the illuminative way. I have known two people who have personally known canonized saints. They've lived with them. And I asked them, of course, what were they like? One was Mother Teresa. The other was Saint Jose Maria Escrivá. I knew people who personally lived with them. I said, what were they? And it's fascinating. They both said the same thing about what it was like to live with saints. Number one, they said, you know, they're a little bit weird. when you're marching to God's drumbeat, you better expect that you're not going to march in lockstep with the drumbeat of the world, are you? Right? It's going to be a little bit weird. But the second thing they said is that they're so free. I remember talking to someone who knew Mother Teresa. And this was his demeanor. He said, she's so free. She's so free. The person who knew St. Jose Maria Escrivá said, you know, he's like a six-year-old kid. It's like there's no rules. It's like he lives his life in absolute freedom. This begins in the illuminative way. And you begin to grasp something of what it means that Christ loves you, although still very mysterious. And you begin to have an understanding of God and of yourself. You know, St. Catherine of Siena once said that the engine of spiritual growth is two things: an awareness of your shortcomings and an awareness of who God is. You have to know both. First of all, you have to know your shortcomings. If you don't know that you are nothing without God, well, then you'll never learn to depend on God. But if you don't learn just how good God is, you'll despair of your shortcomings. Engine of spiritual growth, two things. She used to say you have to dwell in the cell of self-knowledge. and have a deep awareness of who God is. This begins in the illuminative way. And your virtues begin to grow. And your understanding begins to grow. And your purification continues, of course. You're not done yet. Prayer becomes simpler. There's less speaking, more listening. Doing good, which was once so painful, you know, becomes easier. And you begin to recognize that God's grace is at work in every aspect of your life, even misfortunes, even injustices. You begin to really know, not just be told, but really know, God's good all the time. And you become less judgmental. And you start demanding less of other people. And you start expecting less of other people. And you start giving more people the benefit of the doubt and accepting them for who they are with their imperfections. I knew a priest once upon a time, and he says, you know, to become a saint is to learn what it means to chill out. That's the illuminative way. You finally begin to chill out. Good for you. You've made progress, right? Good for you. Your passions are better under the control of your reason. It's quite possible to always avoid mortal sin. However, don't pat yourself on the back too much. Still a long way to go. You're still living in venial sin. You're still looking in your heart for everything that this world has to offer. And throughout your life, you're filled with distractions and imaginations. Now, they're not sinful imaginations or sinful distractions. These aren't wrong things, right? But they're worldly. And what does it do? It gets in the way of what you're really meant to do with your life. At the stage of the illuminative way, you're still something of a mercenary. You love the Lord, but you also expect some stuff from him. You expect a reward from him, both in time and in eternity. You have love for God and for others, but it's tainted with a lot of self-centeredness. And it's imperfect. It's important to note, and I hope this isn't very discouraging, but this is just God's honest truth. This stage is as far as most people get in their life. The rest of the work, the rest of the cleaning, for most people, happens in purgatory. Now, illuminative stage. Why do we call it illuminative? Because God's illuminating us. But don't misunderstand. It's not passive. You know, you're not like a plant sitting back and doing photosynthesis. If you want God to illuminate you, you have to actively cooperate with his grace. If you want to become like him, you have to act like him. Now, every night, I said that I was going to give you something that you could practically do to help grow in this stage. If you want to act like God, there's no better practice to anchor into your life than the practice of mercy. That's what we're going to talk about here this evening. What's mercy? What does it mean? Thomas Aquinas once defined it. He said it's the virtue that influences your will to have compassion for, and if possible, to alleviate another's misfortune. And of course, Jesus says, blessed are those who show mercy, mercy shall be theirs. And if you have an ounce of self-knowledge, you will know that without God's mercy, you're not going to make it. And people recognize this from the very beginning. And that's why the church, from the very beginning, began to make lists of what it means to be merciful. How do I know that I'm being merciful? Well, the very first thing they did was they went to the Sermon on the Mount. They went to the end of the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 25, the story of the Last Judgment, which, as it turns out, was the reading for Mass this morning. That was the Gospel, where Jesus lists six deliberate works of mercy on which you will be judged. Feed the hungry. Give drink to the thirsty. Welcome the stranger. Clothe the naked. Visit the sick. Visit the imprisoned. Now that was just six. We really like sevens in the church, you know? So they searched through the scriptures and they came up with number seven from the book of Tobit, and they added it in the third century. Bury the dead. Highly praised in the book of Tobit. Now, you want to take these things and, you know, God's honest truth, make them a checklist. I knew someone who had a checklist of the seven corporal works of mercy, and he'd done everything except visit the imprisoned, and he found out that his parish had a prison ministry, and he signed up. He said, you know, I want to get all my bases covered. Why not? But you know what people came to discover in the life of the church after the third century? And this is really after the persecutions from ancient Rome ended, and the monastic life in Egypt began to take root and flourish. People began to realize, good as those things were, they weren't the whole of what it means to be merciful to someone, because all of them are just concerned with the body. You're not just body, you're also soul. And gradually over the time, the church developed a list of spiritual works of mercy. And this is what we're going to go over here this evening. We're going to take them one at a time. What does it mean to be merciful? Well, here's a checklist for you. Instruct the ignorant. Counsel the doubtful. Admonish the sinner. Comfort the afflicted. Forgive injuries. Bear wrongs patiently. Pray for the living and the dead. All right, one at a time here. What does it mean to be merciful? Instruct the ignorant. Let's take a look at that. Instruct the ignorant. Don't look now, they're everywhere, right? Okay. The mind was made to know the truth, and the heart was made to love. As I've said before, you're made in God's image. What does that mean? It means two things. It means you have a mind. It's made to know the truth. It means you have a will. That's made to choose love. But what you come to realize is that mind and heart are inseparable. Instructing the ignorant is that act of mercy by which a mind is enlightened by the love of the heart. Now, ignorance. Let's talk about ignorance for just a second. By definition, ignorance is a condition for which we're blissfully unaware. If you know that you're ignorant, you're halfway to knowledge. To instruct somebody else in anything at all is an act of mercy. It sets the mind on the road to truth. Now, how do you instruct the ignorant? Well, guess who we're going to begin with? You want to instruct the ignorant? Begin with yourself, right? You cannot give what you do not have, although many people try. Now, there's all kinds of ignorance. As you know, there's ignorance of art, you can be ignorant of culture, you can be ignorant of literature, you can be ignorant of logic or mathematics or botany, you can be ignorant of politics. It makes you think ignorance is bliss on that last one. And to share any truth in any of these is an act of mercy, but consider, not all truth is equally valuable, is it? I mean, some truth is vital and some truth is trivia. And there's two truths of which you must not be ignorant. Two truths. Number one, truth about yourself. And number two, the truth about God. This is what we're going to instruct the ignorant. And of course, who are we going to start with? I'm going to start with me, right? Believe it or not, most people are ignorant of their own selves. And in fact, even if you don't know this, I'm sure you've had this experience before where you've been in a room and maybe there's someone in that room who's, maybe they're lacking in social graces. Maybe they're a little bit blunt. Maybe they say things in a crowd that they shouldn't say at the expense of somebody else, of course. And maybe you know what it means to have them say something at your expense. You hear them make reference to some trait or quality of yours, and everybody in the room laughs, and you have this realization, like an epiphany. You're like, goodness sakes, is that how I'm perceived? And the answer is yes. If he says it, and she says it, and she says it, you better own it, right? Most of us are completely ignorant of our own selves, and the worst way in which we're ignorant of our own selves is we're ignorant of our sins. St. John Vianney once said that people know about a third of their own sins. You've heard me preach on Sunday. I said, you know, there's a lot of people out there, they don't think they committed any sins at all. People don't know themselves very well. Yeah, how do you fix a problem that you don't know anything about? How do you instruct yourself about yourself? Well, a couple of things you can do. Number one is listen. First of all, listen to your enemies. God is at work in all of them. What was it? Benjamin Franklin, I think it was. He says, give thanks for your enemies, for they teach you your faults. Listen. If there wasn't some truth to it, they wouldn't be saying it, right? Listen to your enemies. Number two, listen to the church. I hope this isn't the case for anybody who's showing up at a 40 hours devotion, but, you know, please, don't play games with the magisterium. Jesus said to his apostles, he who hears you hears me. When the church says it's a sin, it's because it's a sin, right? It's harmful to your basic human nature, and it's harmful to other people as well. Listen to the church. Here's one that's a test if you're praying well. Listen to God in prayer. When you place yourself in God's presence, and you pray honestly, when you open up the scriptures and you do Lectio Divina, if you're open and praying sincerely, you will hear things that you do not like. It's a sign that you're really praying. If the God you pray to is always going along with everything you go along with, if he's always agreeing with you, if he's always cool with what you're cool with, you want to know what? You've just broken the first commandment. Because you're praying to yourself. You've made of yourself an idol. Listen to God in prayer. Here's another thing you can do to know your own self. Watch yourself. Now, take a look at yourself almost as if with a third eye. And look what you do habitually. You know, you want to change your life, change your habits. Some people think they're going to change their life by changing their circumstances. Your life changes when your habits change. What kind of a person are you going to be in a year? What kind of a person are you going to be in 2 years? What kind of a person are you going to be in 2 months? I can answer you that question with just one observation, your own habits. Unless you break those habits, you are going to continue to do the exact same thing tomorrow that you did today. Right? Watch yourself. Look at those habits. And if you can look at those habits as if with a third eye, discover what your motives are. Amor pondus meum, St. Augustine once said. My love is my weight. Love is like gravity. Everything in your life tends towards what you love. If you give a person enough time and let them speak freely, they will invariably speak about what they love. They'll show you a picture of their kid. They'll show you a picture of their vacation home, whatever it might be. Your love is your weight, and you naturally tend towards what you love. Watch yourself. See what you love. Learn what needs to be changed. Like our Lord said, where your treasure is, there will your heart be. You find what needs to be corrected. And please, one fault at a time, right? Don't depress yourself. There's so many to work on. You purify mixed motives. If you're honest with yourself, you'll realize that you're acting from mixed motives all day long. You give money to the poor, partly because you want to help the poor, right? Yes. You know, but partly because you want to get a break on your taxes, or, you know, you got to give something away, or it's going to cost you some amount of money from the much-beloved IRS. Maybe it's a desire to impress somebody. You want people to see what you're doing. Or maybe you go to pray. Partly it's from a desire to pray, but, you know, partly, and this is especially true in churchy circles, we want to be seen as prayerful. We want to be thought of as holy. Purify your mixed motives. To know yourself, it's a very, very great truth. And it leads you to understand that you can be utterly dependent on God because you've got nothing without him. That's the first thing you need to know. You need to know yourself. Secondly, you need to know God. Now, it's a responsibility that everybody has. And I don't care how old you are. You've got to know about your faith. There should be some time, as I mentioned last night, that you spend in prayer. And there needs to be some time every day in which you spend studying. You've got to know about your faith. You cannot love what you do not know. Pick up a spiritual book, right? Read through it at the rate of a few pages a day. Maybe even give it 10 minutes. You'd be amazed the difference you can make in, you know, in just a few weeks. Move on to another. And you know what this does? It helps you instruct the ignorant, because when questions arise, you've got something to offer rather than just your feelings or your opinions. Now, unless you're a priest, unless you're a teacher, your opportunities to instruct the ignorant aren't going to be abundant, except when other people come to you with questions. To be able to answer their questions with the truth of what our church teaches is a very great act of mercy. And one little thing just to keep in mind as you do so. What was it? John Henry Cardinal Newman. He said, cor ad cor loquitur. Heart speaks to heart. All religious instruction is absolutely essential that the messenger deliver the message with love and gentleness. You got to have both mind and heart, or you're not going to reach the person. Instruct the ignorant. It's the first spiritual work of mercy. Let's talk about the second now. Counsel the doubtful. Now, at first blush, counsel the doubtful sounds a lot like instruct the ignorant, until you realize that instructing is about learning. Well, counseling is about helping people make decisions. Counseling has some aspects of teaching, but that's not its main purpose. Here's the etymology of the word counsel. It comes from Latin, of course. It comes from two Latin words, con and cilium, literally with a decision. What's counseling? It's assisting somebody in deciding. It's about the virtue of prudence. I'm not sure if you've studied the cardinal virtues before, but prudence is, it's not being a prude, right? What's prudence? It's the virtue by which you're able to choose from a myriad of options the right thing to do. I knew a man once, he had a little child playing in the bushes. The child got stung by a bee on a hot summer's day. You know how the little venom sac, it does its pulsating thing. And the father knew that, but the child didn't know that. Child screaming in pain, father didn't want to scare the child off, so he distracted him with, I don't know what he said, there's the Goodyear blimp or something like that. Flick the stinger right out of his hand. That's prudence, right? Amidst a myriad of options, he knew exactly what to do. Aristotle said, prudence is reason applied to practice. This is the best way forward. It's based on the situation, and it's based on your available options. You can't always do everything. Counseling. Now, talk about the word doubtful. When people think doubt these days, they think skepticism. A doubtful person might be skeptical of certain truths, but when we're talking about counseling the doubtful, we don't mean that. We're talking about uncertainty in what to choose on the path to holiness. Worldly issues, counseling the doubtful about their mortgage or their retirement plan or anything else, this is not the focus of this. It's concerned with holiness. How to help somebody else get to heaven. Everything in our lives should be directed towards that end. And when someone comes to you with a decision, you want to steer them in a direction, ultimately, that leads them closer to God. I knew a priest once. Talking with altar servers before Mass in the sacristy, the way priests do, if you've ever been back there to see that. And these servers were teenagers, high schoolers, and they're trying to decide where to go to college. The priest says, you know, where are you thinking? And one says state school A, and one says state school B, or private school A, or private school B. Because they offer this off-campus program, or they offer this major. And the priest said, yeah, check out their Catholic Student Center. You know, is it vibrant? Is it alive? Is it dead? Is it faithful to Christ? Is it faithful to the World Health Organization? I mean, what's it like? Go check it out. I'm concerned not so much about where you go to school, but about where you spend eternity. That's counseling the doubtful. And all things ordered towards heaven. If we had the same dedication towards ordering, helping people towards heaven as much as we had with helping them be profitable or succeed in worldly ways, what a difference. I once knew someone who knew one of the quarterbacks of the Washington Redskins back then. And he went down to have coffee with him, and he said, you know, just couldn't you answer me a question? Why are you guys so bad? Why do you always lose? Why can't you be more like Team X up in New England, right? They're always winning. Why aren't you like them? And he goes, oh, well, we have a lousy organization. I said, well, what do you mean a lousy organization? And he says, well, you know, these winning organizations, all they ever think about is winning. Every single decision they ever make all day long is based on one reality. Will it lead us to win? If there's a fight in the front office and someone's disgruntled about their retirement plan, they solve it same day. They don't want anything distracting from winning. Well, we want to be like that too. Except for us, we want to recognize that winning is about getting to heaven. Counseling the doubtful is helping guide others there too. And you can't do it unless you're first dedicated to doing that for yourself. This is a work of mercy for which you must first be docile to the will of God yourself. Heavenly wisdom is a paradox to the worldly minded who only think in terms of dollars and cents. Only if you have a deep prayer life can you offer someone this mercy. Only if you know about scriptures and the lives of the saints can you direct someone toward their eternal end. Only if you've been tried in the crucible of suffering and you know how to persevere and you've met Christ face to face on the road to Calvary. Only if you know what it means to be a faithful Christian in this world can you extend this mercy to another. And over time, you begin to realize that everything that you do in this life, all your prayer, all your study, all your good works, all your sufferings. They're not just for your own sake. Because you know what? Something's really interesting. Nobody goes to heaven alone. And nobody goes to hell alone. If we go to heaven or if we go to hell, we take lots of other people along with us. And we begin to recognize that all of our prayers, works, and actions are not just for our own sake, as though salvation were some sort of private endeavor, but it's for everyone else as well. Counsel the doubtful. Now admonish the sinner. Talk about an act of mercy that's misunderstood. You go back to the letters to the Corinthians, and St. Paul tells a story of a Christian living immorally. And Paul is absolutely livid that nobody's confronted him. And he orders them, he orders the Corinthians, confront this guy and immediately, right? If you don't, his soul might be lost on the day of judgment. Admonishing the sinner. Now, this is not popular, is it? And we need to adjust our understanding from what the world expects to what God expects. Kind of as a general truth about the spiritual life, never put yourself in the judgment seat and put God on trial and judge the scriptures and the saints and Jesus Christ by the standards and measures of this world. Always, but always let it be the opposite, no matter what people think of you as a consequence. Once upon a time, admonishing the sinner was called fraternal correction. He was doing wrong, you knew he was doing wrong, others knew he was doing wrong, you sat him down and you said, you know, hey amigo, you're walking the wrong path. There's a reluctance to correct anybody because, you know, in our own culture, we have this flawed idea that love always means kindness. Love does mean kindness, don't get me wrong. But if you think that love only means kindness, you have a very impoverished understanding of love. I mean, consider that Jesus Christ is love incarnate. You know, and then consider that he busted out a bullwhip in the temple and sent the money changers running in confusion, or, you know, stared the Pharisees in the face and called them a brood of vipers and whitewashed tombs. And you recognize that's love incarnate speaking. And you'll quickly come to the realization that love does not always mean kindness. If it does always mean kindness, you're not loving another person. It regretfully is a manifestation of ego. It also doesn't always mean approval. What does love mean? Once again, it's not a feeling, it's a decision. A decision to do what's best for you, no matter what it costs me. Whether you like it or not, whether you know it or not, whether you asked for it or not, but only for you. That's love. I care about what's really good for you and not your present comfort. Thomas Aquinas once said that to do away with somebody else's evil is the exact same thing as to do him good. Now, the world we live in has succeeded in making us feel ashamed of correcting other people because they think that if you call a sin, that you're judging them, and heaven knows that people who can only quote one line from the scriptures can always quote, you know, thou shalt not judge. So we need to talk about judging for just a moment if we're going to talk about admonishing the sinner. In a culture where tolerance is the highest possible good, judging is the only unforgivable offense. Let's talk about judgment for just a moment. Okay, let's make one thing clear. Some judgments are forbidden, all right? Some judgments are forbidden. You cannot judge if somebody else is better or worse in the sight of God. You just aren't going to know. You cannot judge someone's inner intentions. You can't know what they intended. You can't know how guilty they are. God alone judges in this sense. However, the very Gospels that tell us not to judge also command us to call sin by its name. And this we must do. It's an act of mercy. It's an imitation of Christ. We have to do it in a spirit of gentleness, and we have to brace ourselves as we do it, because if you've ever done this, you know it's not well received, is it? This is one of the hardest mercies to practice. Even when it's done perfectly, even when you've thought things out, run them past others, you've said it as gently as you could read off a prepared script written by Mother Teresa, and the person still gets furious. It's a very, very difficult mercy to practice, but it's important. Check it off on your checkoff list. To fail to correct the sinner is to fail to love him. Comfort the afflicted. Here's one that's misunderstood. Once again, the word comfort comes from Latin, comes from cum fortis. Cum means with. Fortis means strength. What's it mean to comfort someone? Well, it's not just to give them a physical comfort, but ultimately, comforting somebody means restoring them. It means making them strong again. It means bringing them back to a healthy, normal state of being joyful and confident and strong, the way God wants us to be. To comfort the sorrowful, this is very hard to do. It takes patience. It takes sensitivity. And you know what it takes more than anything else? It takes silence. Grief has a logic all its own. And it has to be allowed to run its course. I once heard grief, the entire grieving process, described as a box. And in this box, there's a button. It's called the pain button. And in this box, there's a ball. And the events of life shake that box all about. And that ball bounces around inside that box. And it hits the pain button, and you never know quite when. This is what it means to grieve. And as time goes by, the ball will get smaller and smaller and smaller. And that pain button will be triggered less and less and less. But it never goes away. It's always in there. Grief has a logic all its own. It has to run its course. And sometimes there's not a lot that you can say or that you can do. It's not something you can get around to grieving. The only way through it is through it. And to comfort the sorrowful, sometimes it just means silent, understanding accompaniment. Maybe it just means walking up and, how are you doing today? Sometimes only a few words or a few actions are all that are needed. What's more needed more than anything else is just thoughtfulness. St. Augustine once said that sighs and tears and prayer accomplish more than words. When people are sad, grief and tears are their prayer. And sometimes we need to honor that. Don't run about telling somebody to cheer up. Respect grief. True camaraderie will show you this. And you know what? A really good example of comforting the afflicted? Believe it or not, it's a dog. You know, if you're having a bad day, what does a dog do? They just sit there. And sometimes that's exactly what we need. Now, sometimes people are stuck in grief and they're not making any progress and they need a little bit more than just your silence and your companionship. Once upon a time, I was in a parish. And every morning after Mass, I would kneel before the Blessed Sacrament and I would say some quiet prayers. And every morning, the parish would clear out after the Mass, except for one man who would stare at a photograph and weep for 45 minutes. He would weep and weep and weep. And after 2, 3, 4 months, I decided to approach him and I decided to say, "Hey, what's the matter? Who's that picture of?" He says, this is my daughter who died. So we started talking and I said, "Well, how long ago did she die?" And he said, 15 years. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I mean, there's grieving and then there's getting stuck. Sometimes more is needed. But people need time and they need room. It's an act of mercy to discover what someone needs on their terms, not yours. Forgive injuries. Let's talk about this as an act of mercy. Forgiveness is almost always misunderstood. Almost always misunderstood. People think that forgiveness means I must not have negative feelings. And I don't know if you've had this experience or not, but you know, as a priest going 25, going on 26 years, I found this to be almost universal. The people judge their forgiveness by their feelings. And if they don't have negative feelings about something that happened, that means they're not forgiving. That's not true. We need to understand what forgiveness is, or we're never going to be able to forgive. Let me share with you a question once that really threw me off guard from a irregular churchgoer. Came up to me and said, "Hey, Father, why does God want us to forgive each other?" That really threw me off guard. I mean, we are so used to thinking that we're just supposed to forgive. Sometimes we don't ever stop to ask the question, why? And it's not a bad question to ask. Why forgiveness? Think about it for just a second, right?
I mean, why doesn't God tell us all to get even? Right? Why doesn't God tell us all to get even? Two wrongs don't make it right, but it darn sure makes it even. Wouldn't that be more fair? Why isn't that God's way? And I'll answer you with a story. Now, this story took place right here in our own area, and within the last, say, 10 years. I'll give it a bit of ambiguity to protect the names and identities of the innocent. But there was a girl who was walking home from school. And this she did every day. Until one day, she never arrived home. She disappeared. She was missing for weeks. They looked and they looked, and weeks later, they found her. She'd been attacked. She'd been killed. Her body had been discarded in the woods, and let's just not add any more details. The story made the news. And because the story made the news, the parents of this daughter suddenly heard their doorbell ring one evening, and a man approached they had never seen before. But he says, "I have to talk to you." They said, "Why?" And he said, "Because my daughter was also killed. And I need to talk to you about what it was like." He told them about how grief destroyed his life. How he couldn't concentrate at work. How he lost his job. How he lost his friends. How he lost his health. How the only thing he could think about was the murder and his anger and his bitterness. And the parents realized upon hearing this man speak that they were walking down the same path. And there was only one other option. The only other path was forgiveness. Why does God want us to forgive? I'll give you three reasons. Number one, forgiveness is the only antidote to bitterness. The only antidote. Unforgiveness is an act of self-punishment by which the innocent punishes himself for the crimes of the guilty. Either you choose to forgive, or you will live in smoldering resentment. And I've got news for you. It never goes away. Not in time and not in eternity. Forgiveness is the only freedom. A bit of holy blackmail, right? You have no choice. And God wants you to be free. That's why you forgive. Secondly, forgiveness sets other people free. Now, other people might not ask for forgiveness right away, but anybody with a conscience knows if you've caused evil, you're not free until you know you've been forgiven. And you know, the third reason why we want to forgive is because God forgives. The summit of perfection. It's what Jesus would do. It's what we need to do because we want to be like God. Now, a few corrections here not to misunderstand. Forgiving does not mean you don't still have bad feelings, right? They're all over the place. And it doesn't mean you've forgotten. People always say, forgive and forget. Look, if you can do that, great. But if you can't, don't worry. Join the club. Forgiving does not mean you've forgotten. There are some wrongs that have been imposed on others. You know, they're going to take them to their grave. They're not at fault for that. It also doesn't mean the relationship is healed. Forgiveness does not mean you open your doors wide and welcome in someone who's caused you grief, suffering, abuse, hardship, shipwreck. Forgiveness does not mean you now trust the person again. Trust once broken is very, very hard to restore. And you want to know what else forgiveness does not mean? Forgiveness does not mean there isn't justice. And my favorite example of this is John Paul II, who, as you know, some of us are confessed to be old enough to remembering, that one day in May, I believe the year was 1981, but the Pope was shot in St. Peter's Square at point-blank range by a paid assassin, Ahmet Ali Aka, a Turkish national with ties to the KGB. And the Pope shocked the world by going to Regina Caeli prison and forgiving the guy who tried to kill him. And the man said to him, "My aim was sure. Why are you not dead?" They had an astonishing conversation that day. But there's one thing the Pope did not do. He didn't say, "Well, you know, now you can go free. Here's the..." here's the open door and walk right out of prison. No, there's still justice. That's okay. Forgiveness, as if you heard me preach on Sunday, I said this. Forgiveness means one thing. I do not hold this offense against you. And why? Because that's what we want God to say to us on the day of judgment, isn't it? Unforgiveness will haunt you. Forgiveness will heal you and free you. It's a gift. It's been given to you. And as you have been given, so must you give to others. How is forgiving somebody a work of mercy? Well, you know, considering first it's a work of mercy to your own very self. Your strength and your energy can now be directed towards other things. You're better able to love. And as I said, it's a work of mercy towards those who have harmed us. But almost nothing is more poisonous to ourselves and to others than festering anger and resentment. Forgiveness is healing. Choose it, receive it, share it. Next act of mercy. Bear wrongs patiently. Now there's a cycle of violence and retribution. I'm sure you've noticed this. It all begins with somebody harming another person or slighting another person. And then the harm having been worked, the victim retaliates. And then it escalates. And then it grows. And then it grows. And then it grows. And if someone doesn't take action and curtail it, it can grow completely out of hand. I'll never forget this. Once I was at an airport getting on an airplane, and I saw two men fighting over the use of a plug to charge their phones. Right? These things are worth their weight in gold. And they started fighting over who got there first. And first began the excuse me and the politeness and the feigned politeness, and then the voices got raised. And I guess the two wrong people met each other, you know, right? The two wrong kind of personalities. One just fed off the other. And they started getting louder and louder and louder. And you know, they both got kicked off the flight? Escorted by the TSA right out of the airport, cursing each other all the way. And it was a little preview of hell. That's Satan's economy. And its currency is hatred, and its coinage is revenge. Violence and retribution. To bear wrongs patiently is simply to say this: the cycle of violence and retribution ends with me. You throw a wrench into the gears of Satan's economy. And it's what Jesus did on the cross. He opened not his mouth. He did not retaliate. Straight through to the end. The greatest wrench in the gears of Satan's economy is the cross and those who carry it in Jesus' spirit. You know, Martin Luther King has a great quotation on this, along these lines. He said, you know, darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hatred cannot drive out hatred. Only love can do that. Pride cannot drive out pride. Only humility can do that. Now, when you hear about bearing wrongs patiently, keep this in mind. Must we always bear wrongs patiently? And the answer is a resounding no. Whenever justice is at stake, you must defend yourself and defend others. Bearing wrongs patiently does not mean sitting back while others do you physical bodily harm or harm or destroy your property. Right? You have a moral obligation to defend yourselves and to defend others. So this is not a universal. There are times when you can't cooperate in something evil. Even if it means you don't get the promotion. Even if it means you might lose your job. Even if it means you suffer. Even if it means you'll be arrested. The way things are going in our country, maybe sometime it'll end in death. It doesn't always mean that you bear wrongs patiently. It's just that in nothing that you do is revenge or retaliation ever your goal. When you bear wrongs patiently, you say, the cycle of retribution ends with me. I will take the blow, but I will not return it. And the last act of mercy, pray for the living and the dead. You know, one of the greatest joys of heaven is going to be to see the difference that every prayer made, even your distracted prayers. Do you know what your prayer does right now? When you pray for something, you know what happens? It gives somebody else an unfair spiritual advantage. When you pray, Someone else's mind is inspired. Someone else's will is strengthened. Someone else's heart is enlightened. Someone else is given an unfair spiritual advantage to overcome their temptations and to choose what's good, to offer a prayer for any other person. You hear about someone who died, you say a Hail Mary, say a Glory Be, a great act of mercy, to pray for the living. But here's something that suffered in recent decades, a work of mercy that has suffered in recent decades, and that is to pray for the deceased. I took a retreat once in a monastery in Iowa. And across the street from a monastery was a parish church that dated from the 1870s. And in that parish church was a graveyard. The oldest graves were 1880, 1885, and all the way up to the present day. And I walked the length of the graveyard and I looked at all of the tombstones in the cemetery. And you know, it told a fascinating story. If you look at the oldest tombstones in the cemetery, they were all spiritual and religious, overtly so. They had images of the Blessed Mother, they had images of the Sacred Heart, they had images of the Rosary. They said, Lord, have mercy, Christ, have mercy, blood of Jesus be upon me. Those are the oldest ones. And as time went on, as they became more and more modern, the religious imagery became more subdued, more artistic, more contemporary. The mottos, the prayers, the invocations, these ceased altogether until you came to the modern tombstones, which made no reference to prayer for the deceased or God at all. They had a picture of bowling pins because, I don't know, maybe bowling was their hobby, or a car that they loved, or grandma's favorite recipe for cookies right there on the tombstone. You know, and God bless them, people grieve in all sorts of ways, but it told a story that we've forgotten. The importance of praying for the deceased. We miss a step when a loved one dies. And doesn't this happen at so many funerals? There's these immediate declarations that our deceased are already in heaven. And if they're already in heaven, why do we need to bother praying for them, right? Do you know something fascinating? Scripture doesn't say that we go right to heaven after we die. Because heaven is a place of perfect love. And if you know the truth about yourself, I think one thing you'll have to admit is that you're not yet perfect love. And you're not yet completely cleansed of all your faults. There are sins we've committed, and you know what? We'd do them again. Give me the same circumstances, I'll do the exact same thing. And you know something that's out? You can take this to the bank. Those faults can't get into heaven with you. Because if they did, heaven wouldn't be heaven. Now they say, if we didn't know about purgatory from the teaching of Christ and the tradition of the church and divine revelation, and we do, we need to invent it. I mean, does anybody in their right mind think that they're worthy right now to stand upright in the presence of God? Sometimes I think about this. You know, the sun is, what, 93 million miles away, and you can't look at it. It's too bright. By what logic do you think you can stare straight in the face of the sun's creator? Only someone who doesn't know the greatness of God. People will object. They'll say, wait a minute, didn't Jesus give us all that we need from the cross? Absolutely. But understand this. Just because it's offered doesn't mean it's been received. We're really, really good at fooling ourselves. And we are in a lifelong process of conversion, breaking free from the clutches of unbelief. And for some people, that process is not over at the end of life. You pray for the deceased. Or as St. Ambrose once said, those whom we've loved in this life, we must not abandon in death, until by the help of our prayers, we've carried them safely into the kingdom of heaven. People always wonder what happened to my deceased relatives and friends. And you want to know the honest truth? We're not really sure. Unless they died as, you know, an infant or as a very young child, unless they're a canonized saint, unless they died as a martyr, you don't want to assume they went straight to heaven. You know they weren't perfect. And if you really love them, and if you really want to show them mercy, offer them prayer. Prayer for the deceased is the last spiritual work of mercy, and it leads a soul to glory that God has prepared from the foundation of the world. So, you want to grow in the illuminative way. You want to learn to see Christ more clearly. You want to be free from all of your faults
You want to be less of a mercenary and more of a wholehearted, free, and complete lover of God, as the scriptures have commanded you to. We want to act like God himself. And there may be no action on this earth that makes us more like God than to choose to act in mercy. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the highest stage of the spiritual life, the stage of union, and what we need to do to continue to grow. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit. St. Agnes, pray for us.